I'm Christopher Lydon in my living room again reading Chekhov with actors and friends. Chekhov, the world standard of short story writing, the best model there is out there of the doctor writer. Parenthetically, it goes back a long way, doctors and writers, including the gospel writer Luke, who was supposed to have been a doctor. I want us to read this story, A Medical Case, which is the doctor's story about a young doctor who is sent to examine a situation in a new industrial town in late 19th century Russia. His name is Korolev, and the story speaks for itself, but I just want to be aware that this is the political Chekhov in a sense. He was not for one party or another, but clearly a man with a sense of revolution on the horizon, or something deeply, deeply wrong from a political standpoint. I'll kick it off and then pass it to the readers. Would the readers please just introduce yourselves in a word or two?
I'm Paula Langton. I'm a local actor and a teacher at Boston University.
And I'm Ken Cheeseman. I'm an actor and also an artist in residence at Emerson College.
I'm Donna Sorbello. I'm a local actress and a local teacher of theater studies.
My name is Michael Hammond. I'm also an actor and a director and a playwright, and I'm also on the faculty at Boston University.
I'm Nyazi, went to Emerson College, and I'm an actor.
We're also joined by friends we call the Greek Chorus, listening, commenting, interrupt any time. We say one of the things we love about Chekhov is that he invites digressions and interruptions and bringing it home into 2014. This is A Medical Case, and I'll begin. A professor received a telegram from the Lyalikovs factory asking him to come quickly. The doctor of a certain Mrs. Lyalikov, apparently the owner of the factory, was sick. Nothing more could be understood from the long, witlessly composed telegram. The professor did not go himself, but he sent his intern Korolev in his place. He had to go two stations away from Moscow and then some 3 miles by carriage. A troika was sent to the station to pick Korolev up. The driver wore a hat with a peacock feather and to all questions responded with a loud military, "No, sir," or "Yes, sir." It was Saturday evening, the sun was setting, crowds of workers came walking from the factory to the station and bowed to the horses that were bringing Korolev. And he was enchanted by the evening, and the country houses, and the dachas along the way, and the birches, and that quiet mood all around, when it seemed that, together with the workers, the fields, the woods, and the sun, were preparing to rest on the eve of the holy day, to rest and perhaps to pray. He was born and grew up in Moscow, did not know the countryside, and had never been interested in factories or visited them, but he had chance to read about factories and to visit factory owners and talk with them. And when he saw some factory in the distance or up close, he thought each time of how quiet and peaceful everything was outside, and how inside there must be the impenetrable ignorance and obtuse egotism of the owners, the tedious, unhealthy labor of the workers, squabbles, vodka, vermin. And now, as the workers deferentially and timorously stepped aside before the carriage, in their faces, caps, and gait, he could discern physical uncleanliness, drunkenness, nervousness, perplexity. They drove through the factory gates, and both sides flashed workers' cottages, women's faces, linen, and blankets on the porches. "Watch out!" cried the driver, not reining in the horses. Then came a wide yard with no grass, and in it 5 huge buildings with smokestacks, standing separate from each other, warehouses, barracks, and over everything lay some sort of gray coating as of dust. Here and there, like oases in the desert, were pathetic little gardens and the green or red roofs of the houses where the management lived. The driver suddenly reined in the horses, and the carriage stopped at a house newly painted gray. There was a front garden with dust-colored lilacs and a strong smell of paint on the yellow porch. "Come in, doctor," women's voices said from the hall and the front room, followed by sighs and whispers. "Come in. We've been waiting. It's very bad. Come in here."
Mrs. Lyalikov, a stout elderly lady in black silk dress with fashionable sleeves, but judging by her face, a simple and illiterate one, looked at the doctor with anxiety and hesitated, not daring to offer him her hand. Beside her stood a person with short hair and a pince-nez in a bright multicolored blouse, skinny and no longer young. The servants called her Kristina Dmitrievna, and Korolev figured that she was a governess. It was probably she, as the most educated person in the house, who had been charged with meeting and receiving the doctor, because she at once began hastily explaining the causes of the illness in minute, nagging detail, but without saying who was ill or what was the matter. The doctor and the governess sat and talked, while the mistress stood motionless by the door, waiting. Korolev understood from the conversation that the ill person was Liza, a girl of 20, Mrs. Lyalikov's only daughter, the heiress. She had long been ill and had been treated by various doctors, and during the past night, from evening till morning, she had had such a pounding of the heart that no one in the house had slept for fear she might die. "She's been sickly, you might say, from childhood," Kristina Dmitrievna went on, recounting in a sing-song voice, wiping her lips with her hand now and then. "The doctors say it's nerves, but when she was little, the doctors drove her scrofula inside. So I think it might come from that." They went to see the patient, quite grown up, big, tall, but not pretty, resembling her mother, with the same small eyes and broad, overly developed lower face, her hair undone, the blanket drawn up to her chin. She gave Korolev the impression at first of a wretched, woebegone creature who had been taken in and given shelter here out of pity. And it was hard to believe that she was the heiress to five huge buildings. "And so," Korolev began, "we've come to take care of you. How do you do?"
He introduced himself and shook her hand, a big, cold, uncomely hand. She sat up, and obviously, long accustomed to doctors, not caring that her shoulders and breast were uncovered, allowed herself to be auscultated. "My heart pounds," she said. "All last night, it was so terrible. I nearly died of fright. Give me something for it." I will, calm down." Korolev examined her and shrugged his shoulders. "Nothing's wrong with your heart," he said. "Everything's well. Everything's in order. Your nerves are probably acting up a bit, but that's not unusual. I assume the attack is over now. Lie down and sleep." Just then, a lamp was brought into the bedroom. The sick girl squinted at the light and suddenly clutched her head with her hands and burst into tears. And the impressions of a woebegone and uncomely creature suddenly vanished, and Korolev no longer noticed either the small eyes or the coarsely developed lower face. He saw a soft, suffering look, which was both reasonable and touching, and the whole of her seemed shapely to him, feminine, simple. And he would have liked to comfort her now, not with medications, not with advice, but with a simple, tender word. Her mother embraced her head and pressed it to her. There was so much despair, so much grief in the old woman's face. She, the mother, had nourished and raised her daughter, sparing nothing, had given her whole life to teaching her French, dancing, music, had invited dozens of tutors, the best doctors, had kept a governess, and now she could not understand where these tears came from. Could not understand and was at a loss, had a guilty, anxious, despairing look, as if she had missed something else very important, had failed to do something else, to invite someone else. But whom? She did not know. "Lizanka, again, again," she said, pressing her daughter to her. "My dear, my darling, my child, what's wrong? Have pity on me, tell me." They both wept bitterly. Korolev sat on the edge of the bed and took Liza's hand. "Come, is it worth crying?" he said tenderly. "There's nothing in the world that merits these tears. Let's not cry now. There's no need to." And he thought to himself, "It's time she was married." "Our factory doctor gave her potassium bromide," said the governess. "But I've noticed that it makes her even worse. I think, if it's for her heart, it should be those drops. I forget what they're called, a convalerin or whatever."
And again, there followed all sorts of details. She interrupted the doctor, prevented him from speaking. Zeal was written all over her face, as if she assumed that, being the best educated woman in the house, she had to engage the doctor in ceaseless conversation and about nothing but medicine. Karlov became bored. "I don't find anything in particular," he said, coming out of the bedroom and addressing the mother. "Since the factory doctor has been treating your daughter, let him continue. So far the treatment has been correct, and I see no need to change doctors. Why change? It's an ordinary illness, nothing serious." He spoke unhurriedly, putting on his gloves, while Mrs. Lilakoff stood motionless and looked at him with tear-filled eyes. "It's half an hour till the 10 o'clock train," he said. "I hope I won't be late." "Can't you stay with us?" she asked, and tears poured down her cheeks again. "It's a shame to trouble you, but be so kind, for God's sake!" She went on in a low voice, glancing at the door. "Stay with us overnight. She's my only daughter. She frightened us last night. I can't get over it. Don't leave, for God's sake!" He was about to tell her that he had much work in Moscow, that his family was waiting for him at home. It was hard for him to spend the whole evening and night needlessly in a strange house. But he looked at her face, sighed, and silently began taking off his gloves. All the lamps and candles were lighted for him in the reception room and the drawing room. He sat at the grand piano and leafed through the scores, then examined the paintings on the walls, the portraits. The paintings, done in oils, with gilded frames, were views of the Crimea. A stormy sea with a little boat, a Catholic monk with a wine glass, and all of them dry, slick, giftless. Not a single handsome, interesting face among the portraits, everywhere wide cheekbones, astonished eyes. Lyalikov, Liza's father, had a narrow forehead and a self-satisfied face. The uniform hung like a sack on his big plebeian body. On his chest he had a medal and the badge of the Red Cross. The culture was poor, the luxury accidental, unconscious, ill at ease like his uniform. The gleam of the floors was annoying. The chandelier was annoying, and for some reason brought to mind the story of the merchant who went to the bathhouse with a medal on his neck. From the front hall came a whispering. Someone quietly snored, and suddenly sharp, abrupt, metallic noises came from outside, such as Karlov had never heard before and could not understand now. They echoed strangely and unpleasantly in his soul. "I don't think I'd ever stay and live here for anything," he thought, and again took up the scores. "Doctor, come and have a bite to eat," the governess called in a low voice. He went to supper. The table was big, well furnished with food and wines, but only two people sat down, himself and Kristina Dmitrievna. She drank Madeira, ate quickly, and talked, looking at him through her pince-nez. "The workers are very pleased with us. We have theatricals at the factory every winter. The workers themselves act in them, and there are magic lantern lectures, a magnificent tea room, and whatever you like. They're very devoted to us, and when they learned that Lizanka was worse, they held a prayer service for her. They're uneducated, and yet they too have feelings." "It looks as if you have no men in the house," said Korolev. "Not one. Pyotr Nikanorovich died a year and a half ago, and we were left by ourselves, so there's just the three of us. In the summer we live here, and in the winter in Moscow, on Polyanka Street. I've been with them for 11 years now, like one of the family." For supper, they were served sterlet, chicken cutlets, and fruit compote. The wines were expensive, French. "Please, doctor, no ceremony," said Kristina Dmitrievna, eating and wiping her mouth with her fist, and it was obvious that her life there was fully to her satisfaction. "Please, eat." After dinner, the doctor was taken to a room where a bed had been made for him. But he did not want to sleep. It was stuffy, and the room smelled of paint. He put his coat on and went out. It was cool outside. Dawn was already breaking, and in the damp air, all five buildings with their tall smokestacks, the barracks and warehouses, were clearly outlined. Since it was Sunday, no one was working. The windows were dark, and only in one of the buildings was a furnace still burning. The two windows were crimson, and along with smoke, fire occasionally came from the smokestack. Further away, beyond the yard, frogs were croaking, and a nightingale sang.
Looking at the buildings and at the barracks where the workers slept, he again thought what he always thought when he saw factory workers. There may be theatricals for workers, magic lanterns, factory doctors, various improvements, but even so, the workers he had met that day on his way from the station did not look different in any way from the workers he had seen back in his childhood, when there were no factory theatricals or improvements. As a physician, he could make correct judgments about chronic ailments, the fundamental cause of which was incomprehensible and incurable, and he looked at factory workers as misunderstanding the cause of which was also obscure and irremediable. And while he did not consider all the improvements in the workers' lives superfluous, he saw them as equivalent of treating an incurable illness. This is a misunderstanding, of course, he thought, looking at the crimson window. 1,500, 2,000 factory hands work without rest and in unhealthy conditions, producing poor quality calico, starving, and only occasionally sobering up from this nightmare in a pothouse. 100 men serving the work, and the whole life of those 100 men goes into levying fines, pouring out abuse, being unjust, and only the 2 or 3 so-called owners enjoy the profits, though they do not work at all, and scorn poor quality calico. But what profits, and how do they enjoy them? Mrs. Lalikov and her daughter unhappy. It is just pity to look at them. Only Kristina Dmitrievna, a rather stupid old maid, in the pince-nez lives in her full satisfaction. And so it turns out that all 5 of these buildings work, and poor quality calico is sold on the eastern markets only so that Kristina Dmitrievna can eat starlet and drink Madeira. Strange sounds suddenly rang out, the same that Korolev had heard before supper. Near one of the buildings, someone banged a metal bar. Banged and stopped the sound at once, so that what came out were short, sharp, impure sounds like durr, durr, durr. Then a 30-minute of silence, and then sounds ran out by another building, as sharp and unpleasant, but lower now, more bass. Dring, 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 11 times. Evidently, this was a watchman banging out 11 o'clock. From near, another building came, Jacques, 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 and so on near in all the buildings, and then beyond the barracks and the gates. And in the silence of the night, it seemed as if these sounds were being produced by a crimson-eyed monster, the devil himself, who ruled here over both owners and workers and deceived the ones like the others. Korolev went out to the yard, into the fields. Who goes there? A coarse voice called to him by the gates. Just like a prison, he thought, and he did not answer. Here the nightingales and frogs could be heard better. You could feel the May night. The noise of a train came from the station. Sleepy cocks crowed somewhere, but even so the night was still. The world slept peacefully. In the field, not far from the factory, a house frame stood, with building materials piled by it. On some planks, Korolev sat on some planks and went on thinking. Nobody feels good here except the governess and the factory workers for her satisfaction. But it just seems so. She's only a straw man here. The main one that everything here is done for is the devil. And he thought about the devil, in whom he did not believe, and kept glancing back at the 2 windows gleaming with fire. It seemed to him that the devil himself was gazing at him through those crimson eyes, the unknown power that created the relations between the strong and the weak, the grave mistake that now could in no way be set right. It had to be that the strong hindered the life of the weak. Such was the law of nature, but this thought could be clearly and easily formulated only in a newspaper article or a textbook, while in the mishmash that is everyday life, in the tangle of all the trifles of which human relations are woven, it was not the law, but a logical incongruity, when strong and the weak alike fell victim to their mutual relations and inadvertently obeying some controlling power, unknown, extraneous to life, alien to man. So, thought Korolev, as he sat on the planks, and the feeling gradually came over him that this unknown, mysterious power was in fact close by and watching. Meanwhile, the east grew paler, the time passed quickly. Against the gray background of the dawn, with not a sound around, as if everything had died out, the five buildings and smokestacks had a peculiar look, different from in the daytime. The steam engines, electricity, telephones inside them left one's mind, and one somehow kept thinking of piled dwellings of the Stone Age. One sensed the presence of crude, unconscious power, and again came the banging. Durr, 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 durr. 12 times. The stillness, half a minute of stillness, and from the other end of the yard came dring, dring, dring. Terribly unpleasant, thought Korolev. Shack, shack, came from a third place, abruptly, sharply, as if in vexation. Shack, shack. And it took them about 4 minutes to strike 12. Then it was still. And again, the impression was if everything around had died out.
Mm. Can I just say, I mean, that durr, durr, yeah. Durr, this industrial banging. It's so like the destruction of the cherry trees at the end of Cherry Orchard, isn't it? I mean, like, bang, bang, bang. The trees are coming down.
Yeah.
Off stage. Mm.
The rhythm of quote-unquote progress.
Amen. Yeah. Amen.
Korolev sat a while longer and then went back to the house, but he did not go to bed for a long time. There was whispering in the neighboring rooms, a shuffling of slippers and bare feet. Is she having another fit? Thought Korolev. He went to have a look at the patient. It was already quite light in the rooms, and on the walls and floor of the reception room, sunlight trembled faintly, having broken through the morning mist. The door to Liza's room was open, and she was sitting in an armchair by the bed, in a robe, a shawl around her shoulders, her hair undone. The window blinds were drawn. How are you feeling? Asked Korolev. Well, thank you. He took her pulse, then straightened the hair that had fallen across her forehead. You're not asleep, he said. The weather is wonderful outside. It's spring. The nightingales are singing, and you sit in the dark and brood on something. She listened and looked into his face. Her eyes were sad, intelligent, and it was clear that she wanted to say something to him. Does this happen to you often? He asked. She moved her lips and answered, often. I feel oppressed almost every night. Just then the watchman in the yard began striking 2. Durr, durr. And she gave a start. Does this rapping upset you? He asked. I don't know. Everything here upsets me, she said, and thought a little. Everything. I hear sympathy in your voice. At the first sight of you, I thought for some reason that I could talk with you about everything. Please do talk. I want to tell you my opinion. It seems to me that I'm not ill, but I'm upset and afraid because that's how it should be and it can't be otherwise. Even the healthiest person can't help being upset. If, for instance, a robber is prowling under his windows. I've been treated often, she went on, looking into her lap and smiling bashfully. I'm very grateful, of course, and I don't deny the benefits of the treatment. But I'd like to talk. Not to a doctor, but to someone close to me, a friend who would understand me, who could convince me that I'm either right or wrong. You don't have any friends? Asked Korolev. I'm lonely. I have my mother. I love her. But still I'm lonely. Life has worked out this way. Lonely people read a lot, but talk little and hear little. Life is mysterious for them. They're mystics and often see the devil where he's not. Lermontov's Tamara was lonely and saw the devil. And you read a lot? Yes. My time is all free, from morning till evening. During the day, I read, but in the night, my head is empty. There are some sort of shadows instead of thoughts. Do you see things at night? Asked Korolev. No, but I feel... Again, she smiled and raised her eyes to the doctor and looked at him so sadly, so intelligently, and it seemed to him that she trusted him, wanted to talk openly with him, and that she thought as he did. But she was silent, perhaps waiting for him to speak.
And he knew what to tell her. It was clear to him that she ought quickly to leave those five buildings and the million, if she had it, to leave that devil who watched at night. It was also clear to him that she herself thought so too, and was only waiting for someone she trusted to confirm it. But he did not know how to say it. How? It was mortifying to ask condemned people what they were condemned for, just as it is awkward to ask very rich people what they needed so much money for, why they disposed of their wealth so badly, why they would not abandon it, even when they could see it was to their own misfortune. And if such a conversation began, it usually turned out to be embarrassing, awkward, long. How to say it, pondered Korolev. And need I say it? And he said what he wanted to say, not directly, but in a roundabout way. You're not content in your position as a factory owner and a rich heiress. You don't believe in your right to it. And now you can't sleep, which of course is certainly better than if you were content, slept soundly, and thought everything was fine. Your insomnia is respectable. In any event, it's a good sign. In fact, for our parents, such a conversation as we're having now would have been unthinkable. They didn't talk at night. They slept soundly. But we, our generation, sleep badly, are anguished, talk a lot, and keep trying to decide if we're right or not. But for our children or grandchildren, this question, whether they're right or not, will be decided. They'll see better than we do. Life will be good in 50 years or so. It's only a pity we won't make it that far. It would be interesting to have a look. And what will the children and grandchildren do? Asked Liza. I don't know. They'll probably drop it all and leave. For where? Where? Why, wherever they like, said Korolev, and he laughed, as if there weren't lots of places a good, intelligent person can go. He glanced at his watch. The sun is up, however, he said. It's time you slept. Get undressed and have a good sleep. I'm very glad to have met you, he went on, pressing her hand. You are a nice, interesting person. Good night. He went to his room and slept. Next morning, when the carriage drove up, everybody came out on the porch to see him off. Liza was festive in a white dress with a flower in her hair, pale, languid. She looked at him, as yesterday, sadly and intelligently, smiled, talked, and all with an expression as if she would have liked to say something special, important, to him alone. One could hear the larks singing, the church bells ringing, the windows of the factory shone merrily, and driving through the yard and then on the way to the station, Korolev no longer remembered the workers, or the pile dwellings, or the devil, but thought about the time, perhaps close at hand, when life would be as bright and joyful as this quiet Sunday morning. And he thought about how nice it was on such a morning
in springtime, to ride in a good carriage with a troika and feel the warmth of the sun. December, 1898.
Thank you, readers. Thank you, Anton. I mean, I think this is pre-revolutionary Chekhov. There's that line where he says, life will be good in 50 years or so. It's only a pity we won't make it that far. Mm-hmm. It would be interesting to have a look. I mean, there's a line, isn't there, in Uncle Vanya, where the doctor says pretty much
Castro,
the same thing.
Yeah, yeah, in 100 years.
Yeah.
In 100 years.
Yeah. So this is the short. Horizon.
And Trofimov says virtually the same thing in the cherry orchard as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a familiar refrain.
So, what do we make of it, Michael?
I was waiting for the irony, and I think it comes in the last paragraph when this man who sees clearly, speaks clearly, has the soul of a poet and a bit of political vision, opts for the comfort of life on the earth, the warmth, the beauty. This man is not going to the barricades.
He's enjoying the carriage and the troika the warmth of the sun too much. I wonder. It's hard to come back, though, from his judgment that this town only works for one person, that's the governor's. Everybody else is a screaming nutcase. And second, almost in a theological way. I mean, Chekhov was he did not confess to any religion, but this is the devil at work. There may not be a god, but there's a devil, and the devil runs this town.
It's remarkably explicit, but the final note is complacent.
It felt hopeful to me instead of complacent.
I thought it was his escape. I thought he was relieved to have escaped.
I'm out of here.
That he's got out of the grip of the devil. And he's thrilled now at every little teeny thing because he's so happy to leave all that behind.
Regarding hope and hopefulness, that was a familiar refrain in the earlier discussion as well.
Yeah.
I want to say respectfully that that's what we wish was being said. I don't think it's being said. I don't think that's hope. To my mind, that's a resignation, withdrawal. It's still poetic. It's a way of making life meaningful, but to look at life on earth, not life in this society.
But, you know, doesn't it remind you of the ending of The Student, which we read? The Student tells the story of Peter betraying Jesus and his evening with the peasant women, and he wanders home in a state of almost unaccountable exhilaration and ecstasy. Easter's coming. There is a very religious expectation there. I think this is entirely different. I think he's having a happy moment in a plush taxi, but no, he has seen the devil, and he has seen a system that does not work for people, for anybody, and he knows that there is a storm coming. I think also this is part of why Chekhov seems so modern. I mean, we ask ourselves today, in a 99%, you know, economy, remind me, who's this working for? Who's happy? Who's getting something out of this? The governors, by accident. And he's telling us, you know, that our storm is still coming too. What do we think?
There seems to be one hopeful note in that Liza has made some connection with the outside world. Something has resonated in her that she only wants to talk to him. There's the possibility of change because there's one little door that's been opened that she's aware of.
I thought it was interesting how, like Uncle Vanya too, that here's this doctor who is not only a medical doctor, but he's also sort of diagnosing the existential condition, which is what he really does in this story. And in the Vanya, either 100 years or 1,000 years, whatever he says, he's looking forward to whatever that hopeful future is. But then also the irony now, looking back, and how sad, if you think 50 years ahead from 1896, it's the end of World War II, you know, and 20 million Russians have been killed. It's even more poignant looking back to think, you know, oh, in 1890s, you think, oh, this great change is burgeoning and revolution is coming. But then, boy, 50 years later, looks pretty grim.
Sarah Lydon, what are you thinking?
No, I mean, not that it's, that there's kind of a step in the right direction in his coming to recognize her as, if not a kindred spirit, as a kind of a yearning intelligence, and that, yeah, again, acknowledging that it's not a medical problem, that, like, no, you shouldn't be sleeping. And, like, that the first step is kind of understanding that, like, yeah, no, you're not sick. You're not...
You know, absolutely,
you're not
right.
Sick. It's all in your head.
You're not sick. You're not crazy. There's a problem out there.
Yeah. Someone understands you, too.
Which is a subversive message. To me, it's the classic neurasthenic. It was before Freud had, you know, codified his talking medicine. Talk about modern. Chekhov already has that insight. She needs somebody to talk to. So if there is hope in the story, it's that this woman has found someone she can talk to.
Mm. I love that he has that thing that he says to her. In fact, for our parents, such a conversation as we're having right now would have been unthinkable. They didn't talk at night. They slept soundly. But we, our generation, sleep badly and are anguished, talk a lot, and keep trying to decide if we're right or not.
Right. Nothing wrong with you, girl. Your heart's fine.
Yeah.
You had a bad night. But we should be talking about this.
We should be talking about it.
Yeah. Well, isn't that the moral of reading Chekhov? We should be talking about this. We've got each other. Praise God. Thank you, Anton. Thank you, Nyazi. Thank you, Paula. Thank you, Michael. Thanks to our Greek chorus. Mary McGrath produced and edited this Reading Chekhov podcast series with help from Kunal Jasti. No end of thanks to our readers, Michael Hammond, Donna Sorbello, Kathleen Donahue, Lewis Wheeler, Nyazi Yousafi, Paula Langton, and Ken Cheeseman, and to our Greek chorus of responders and commentators. Special thanks to an extraordinary audio engineer, Jim Donahue, for wiring us all for sound and making it sound also good. Thanks to our friend Tian Ying for his performance of Rachmaninoff's Variations on a Theme of Corelli, Opus 42. Listeners, please leave a comment on Chekhov or our reading of the great man at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of our Reading Chekhov podcast project.